It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers identify a new E. coli strain that could cause more serious complications in people who are infected. As we discuss bacteria that causes a number of foodborne illnesses, call in with a question or comment about food contamination. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jerry Barak is a professor of plant pathology at UW-Madison, where she studies plant-microbe interactions. Jerry, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. This new strain of E. coli has contaminated romaine lettuce and led to hospitalizations of dozens of people. And then the Washington Post reports a strain actually emerged about 8 years ago and has been recurring. How serious can E. coli be to people who are infected?
So E. coli, Shigatoxin-carrying E. coli can be serious, mostly for the elderly, the young, and the immunocompromised. For healthy individuals, they will get bloody diarrhea, but it would be very rare for the illness to progress and for them to be hospitalized unless they're in those three groups, the young, the elderly, or the immunocompromised.
E. coli bacteria that normally live in our intestines, how does it become toxic to us?
That's a great question. Yes, everyone needs E. coli. So some people think that there are the good E. coli and the bad E. coli. And the bad E. coli are the ones that produce Shigatoxin. And it's the Shigatoxin that causes the bloody diarrhea and further illness.
Can washing your greens prevent infection from E. coli?
We wish it would, but unfortunately, bacteria have a lot of ways to stick to leaves, to your leafy greens. And so washing could reduce the number of bacteria maybe a little bit if they're not securely attached, but bacteria very quickly, when they arrive on a plant, secure themselves and cannot just be simply rinsed away.
And that's for produce. What about meat? Can cooking meat to a certain temperature prevent E. coli or kill off the bacteria?
Absolutely. So that's a fundamental difference between meat and contamination with leafy greens. With meat, we do have an elimination step. We can heat the meat to the appropriate temperatures and essentially kill the bacteria. But I don't know about you, I don't often heat up my leafy greens, and therefore we don't have a way to kill the bacteria on the lettuce and the other leafy greens we use in our salads.
Are there any visible signs on the produce that would, you know, make you suspect something is wrong?
Right. So from E. coli, no, there aren't any visible signs. E. coli doesn't infect plants, so you wouldn't know that it's there. However, in our research group, we study risk factors that can increase the populations of E. coli and Salmonella on leafy greens. And we have found that when plants are infected with plant pathogens, then you have a higher risk of having more E. coli or more Salmonella in your leafy greens. So one of the things we tell consumers is to try and buy the best looking leafy greens that they can. When they see disease on their plants, they should probably avoid purchasing those or consuming those.
Jerry Barak is with us, professor of plant pathology at UW-Madison, where she studies plant-microbe interactions. And we talk about foodborne illnesses, E. coli, how people can stay safe in their making their foods. You can join in with your questions about food contamination. Call in with a question or comment at 800-642-1234. Jerry, what about boiling cabbage? Could that make cabbage in particular safe to eat?
Yes, boiling cabbage kept at you know, brought to the appropriate temperature for the appropriate amount of time would kill the bacteria.
How does the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention know when there is an outbreak of foodborne illness? What are the steps?
That's a great question. So the CDC uses PulseNet, and PulseNet is a partnership with the Association of Public Health Laboratories that are usually found in every state in the country and other federal partners. And when you get sick, when you go to the doctor and you give a stool sample, it's sent to a laboratory. Bacteria are isolated from those samples, and then DNA fingerprints are uploaded to PulseNet. Now, not every time someone gets sick and a sample is taken is it what's considered an outbreak. Every state in the nation has what we call sporadic illness. Some level of E. coli illness or Salmonella illness that happens not due to a coordinated outbreak, but when the number of the same DNA fingerprints are starting to be uploaded to PulseNet above the sporadic illness level, that indicates that it's possible that there is an outbreak. And if the same DNA fingerprint shows up in two different states, that's more likely that there is an outbreak, and it signals that to the system that it's possible that there's an outbreak happening, and then an investigation begins.
In the investigation, how difficult is it to trace to the farm where the contamination is occurring?
Good question. So once it's known through PulseNet that it appears that there could be an outbreak, depending on the population of humans that are getting sick, for instance, if the group are women between the ages of 18 and 35, that might alert the epidemiologist that this could be an outbreak associated with leafy greens. And so the epidemiologists, they come up with a hypothesis. We think that there's an outbreak that's occurring with leafy greens with this one DNA fingerprint. And so then they start to do interviews with the folks that submitted the samples. What did you eat? And trying to narrow down what are the similarities between all of the outbreak cases. And then they have another set of folks that are the same demographics that aren't ill. What did you eat in the last 3 days or 5 days? And that helps to narrow down what the culprit could be. And if it's leafy greens, if people can identify what they ate very, very specifically, then companies could be alerted, and the investigation goes on like that. So it's kind of a multi-step process.
It sounds multi-step. And is there a coordinated and orchestrated effort here? Are all states reporting cases to the CDC?
All states that belong to PulseNet report to the CDC. As soon as the DNA fingerprints are available, or whole genome sequences, they go straight into PulseNet. And so there could be automated parts of the system that as soon as the number of cases rise above the background sporadic illness level or identical fingerprints in different states, that starts the ball rolling. And it can go very quickly.
UW-Madison plant pathologist Jerry Brock fielding questions about contaminated produce, foodborne illness outbreaks. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question, share a concern, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Thank you. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Researchers shed light on a newly identified strain of E. coli that could cause more severe disease in people who are infected. As we discuss foodborne illnesses and how to prevent contamination, call in with a question, add a perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Jerry Barak with us, professor of plant pathology at UW-Madison. Jerry, you're explaining PulseNet and comparing the DNA fingerprints of bacteria and finding clusters of disease. What other foodborne illnesses are being tracked by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention?
So PulseNet is specifically for foodborne illness. So they track Salmonella, E. coli, and Listeria.
Okay. And last month, the CDC reported 18 cases of salmonella in Wisconsin related to outdoor chickens. How does salmonella spread?
Salmonella spreads similarly to E. coli. Its preferential hosts are animals. And animals, many animals can carry both salmonella or E. coli but not be sick. Even the ones that are pathogenic, such as the Shigatoxin-producing E. coli that we were talking about, cattle are a reservoir for E. coli, but cattle don't become ill. Humans become ill. Salmonella can also be carried by cattle and many other types of animals, and both of them most likely contaminate produce pre-harvest in the field through contaminated irrigation water is probably the most likely source.
I wanted to ask you about water irrigation systems and what are the challenges there with contamination? What do you find?
So what they have found when they have done epidemiological studies on farms is that surface waters can carry both Shigatoxin-producing E. coli and Salmonella. Water is tested often on large and medium-sized farms, especially leafy green production in California and Arizona, which is the largest production in the country. They do test the water on a regular basis, but both surface waters and well waters can be contaminated with E. coli.
How about beaches? I'm thinking about lakes and streams. Are there issues there with contamination?
The studies that have been done, yes, in all those cases that you listed, yes, they can all be contaminated with both Salmonella and E. coli. When they've done studies to go out into the environment and look for outbreak strains, Salmonella on the eastern shore of Virginia, where we have a lot of tomato production and where tomatoes have been the source of outbreaks, the outbreak strain has been found in streams and in ponds and in ditches in California. Similarly, in streams after rain events, it's more likely to isolate outbreak strains of E. coli where cattle production is at a higher rate, more likely to have findings of these pathogens. But as I said, also you have birds and wild animals that are carriers of these bacteria as well, even when these animals are healthy.
That's interesting. I know you have done just a casual survey of your students on who thinks they've had food poisoning in the past, and you get a lot of hands raised. When is it time to go to the doctor?
Right. So when we think about the number of people that actually end up in an outbreak, it's very small. It's like the tip of the iceberg compared to the number of people that were actually ill. You can imagine in both the cases of Shigatoxin E. coli and Salmonella, the symptoms are diarrhea. And so when you ask folks, like, how many people think they've had foodborne illness, almost everyone can, raises their hand. And then you ask, well, how many of you went to the doctor? Almost nobody raises their hand because, quite frankly, they don't want to leave their house or get very far away from the toilet in those cases. But if you don't go to the doctor and they don't take a stool sample, then you will never be counted in an outbreak. So the numbers that are reported, sometimes they even look large. It's much larger than that for each outbreak.
So very much under reporting there. Jerry Barak, professor of plant pathology at UW-Madison, as we talk about foodborne illnesses and how people can stay safe. You can join in with your questions. You can share a comment, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jerry, the recent E. coli outbreak involving romaine lettuce grown in California's Salinas Valley, are California foods riskier to eat?
I don't think that that's a fair conclusion to say California leafy greens are riskier to eat. I think what the situation is California produces the most leafy greens in the country, and then they are distributed throughout the country. And so, sure, Salinas Valley comes up often when we're talking about these leafy green outbreaks, but that's because they are the producers of our leafy greens. In fact, the producers in California were the first to organize after the 2008 E. coli spinach outbreak, and they came together and started to look at food safety risk in their own production scenarios, and they started to monitor themselves. So I wouldn't say at all that the leafy greens from California are the most susceptible. It's just
Farmers are organizing, and it sounds like being very proactive on this, knowing the risks to their farm and to the larger population. As you look at climate change, intensifying storms and flooding and drought, is the risk of foodborne illnesses growing?
I think any time that you have unusual scenarios pre-harvest, such as flooding events or other conditions that either stress the plants or stress the animals that are in the same ecosystem, you could increase the risk for foodborne illness, either increase the risk of the pathogen being in the irrigation water, increase the risk that contaminated water could inundate farms. I think that the risk could be higher with climate change.
And what about these strains that emerge, the bacteria strains? Could they become more severe as time goes on?
We don't have any evidence that they're becoming more severe. The E. coli that they're talking about recently that has been reoccurring, it's suggested that it's now endemic in the environment. So it may be more common that we see the same outbreak strain because it has a foothold now in the environment and isn't, you know, disappearing from the environment. But I don't think that you'll have a lot of genetic reshuffling in the near future. There's no evidence that is happening.
Once, as you say, it's established in the environment, does that change your research at all?
Well, I think when certain bacterial strains become endemic in the environment, they'll be almost impossible to eliminate. Mm. We'll just have to recognize that they are in the environment and that there is a risk. And we go back to those three populations that we talked about earlier. There might be some periods of time where we have to be more cautious when we're going to eat raw produce. If we fall into those three categories, we may have to shift our healthy vegetable and fruit consumption when we enter, you know, those categories that are more likely to have severe illness.
Jerry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Jerry Barak is a professor of plant pathology at UW-Madison, where she studies plant-microbe interactions. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Projects to support rural communities and tribal nations in Wisconsin get a funding boost through the Wisconsin Rural Partnership Initiative. We learn about one program called the Rural Livability Project and what it could do for sparsely populated areas of Wisconsin. As we discuss rural issues, call in with a question, share your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tessa Conroy is an associate professor at UW-Madison and economic development specialist. Tessa, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. The Rural Livability Project you lead was recently awarded federal funding. What will this funding allow you to do?
With the Rural Livability Project, we are wanting to identify the factors, or rather the system of factors, that contribute to long-term livability, or what sustains rural communities over time. We were motivated by seeing challenges that rural communities are facing, particularly in terms of losing critical institutions. So we look at rural communities, oftentimes there's the loss of a major employer, maybe they lose a healthcare provider or a clinic, then goes the pharmacy, then maybe a grocery store. And it's kind of this death by a thousand cuts that happens over time. And it makes it harder and harder for people to meet their needs on a routine basis and stay in these communities. They become less and less livable.
So it's this kind of chain reaction that you see in these sparsely populated areas.
That's what we're interested in better understanding, kind of what happens first, what's the order of events, is there a way to prioritize certain features of the community that can sustain it in the long run, because we know it's not happening everywhere. Some rural communities are doing really well. So can we study those places that are doing well, that are thriving, that have sustained themselves, and figure out, like, what's the recipe or what's the blueprint for their success?
Have rural areas always faced problems like these? Have they always had this type of chain reaction, especially when a major employer goes dark?
You know, when we look at least the last several decades, I think the challenges for rural areas have certainly been mounting. I expect that, you know, going back over time, we will always find rural residents in rural places that have struggled. But it does seem to be the case that we've become more alert to the challenges, at least in the last, you know, 10, 20, 30 years.
Let's take a call now. Dave is joining us from Toma. Dave, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Yeah, I want to know why we have to make these places thrive or sustain them, because Wisconsin's a rural state and people like it that way. And invading the rural community more is just the opposite of what we need today with climate change and things.
Dave, thank you for calling in. Tessa, what do you make of that perspective?
Yeah, I think that he makes a good point. I think that what I hear is this equating of rural success with growth, and that's not necessarily what we're talking about with this project. I think it's quite possible that rural communities can do well through stability, that it's not necessarily about economic growth, about adding people. The recipe for success in some places might be, you know, sustained population and, you know, a certain consistency over time.
Rural is a term that may mean different things to different people. How does your project determine a rural area?
Right. That's a fairly complicated question. So even when we look at, like, the federal level, there are about 10 or so working definitions of how we could define rural areas. We're certainly alert to those, and we'll probably be using multiple definitions of rural, looking for robustness across these different ways of measuring rural. But we want to be paying attention to also how communities see themselves. That's maybe what's most important is, does a place identify itself as a rural community? And if so, how can we engage with them to help them meet their goals?
In terms of Census Bureau data, what do you see there in you know, classifying an area as rural?
Yeah, so the census system for rurality is interesting. So the definition changes about every 10 years. The Office of Management and Budget is going to update what we call urban and rural every 10 years or so. And that's typically based on population and distance to a metro area. But what it means in practice is that rural places that grow or get bigger, that add population, are going to sort of graduate or move up into the metro category. So what's left over time is that these rural places, and again, I don't consider growth to be synonymous with success, but the rural places that grow are going to move into metro. So it looks like metro areas are always doing really well. And then what's left in the rural category is sometimes those places that have been stable or even declining. So it always kind of looks like rural is lagging behind metro. And I think that's really important to understand about the way these definitions work.
Tessa Conroy with us, associate professor and an economic development specialist at UW-Madison, as we look at efforts to make a rural area more livable and stable. You can join in with your questions, your comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tessa, last year, the U.S. Census Bureau changing its classification for rural, and previously places with more than 2,500 people were urban. Now the threshold is 5,000 people. And we talked with Jerry DeShane, who leads the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. He told us in January that many places in Wisconsin could suffer from this change.
When a company is looking to relocate to an area, they only look at what are called metropolitan service areas. And those are not rural areas. Those are urban areas. And in Wisconsin, we've just taken 40 cities and villages off that list.
So how much does the federal government's classifications affect economic development or funding opportunities?
Yeah, I think those limitations and challenges are real for those communities experiencing a change. You know, it can affect, as we heard, what lists they show up on. And so who's getting to see them, perhaps in terms of business location, perhaps in terms of, you know, grant applications and the funding that's available to them. So I certainly think when we look kind of community by community, we should expect to see some places that are frustrated by this change because it is going to impact their opportunities.
As you move into the Rural Livability Project, what research, what data, what figures support your research, and what do you know so far that will inform how you carry out this project?
Yeah, so, you know, we're starting from the beginning, from a simple place of just a working definition of what is livability, and we expect that it's those places where people can enjoy what they appreciate and meet their needs on a routine basis. And it's a simple definition, but it lets us use a data-driven approach to identify livable communities. We think that the data will help us find the livable communities because human behavior will tell us where they are. So we're looking for places, for example, that have perhaps high in-migration because people are going to want to live there. That's a signal of livability. They might have low out-migration, a signal that people want to stay because they like living there. We might expect that people want to start businesses there. So we would look at startup activity. We might also expect housing values to appreciate. We might expect that these are places where people want to have families, so we can look at fertility rates. These are all indicators that a place is livable. No one indicator is going to completely tell us the story. So we're looking at combining factors, looking at what people's choices are telling us, and using this combination to identify livability. From there, we can start to think about different types of livable communities. We don't expect that they're all the same. And then we'll look at those different types and think about what are the key characteristics that are feeding into livability. So in one community or type, it might be that tourism, maybe a slightly older demographic, maybe rich cultural amenities are really part of their recipe for long-term livability. But in another type of community, it might be that a great school system and a demographic that skews towards families and parks and has critical institutions like great clinics and healthcare, that's their recipe for long-term livability. So we want to identify these types and then look for the critical institutions and features of those communities that feed into that long-term success.
One indicator you didn't bring up, and something is something that we often, I think, look to, is whether a downtown area is thriving, you know, or like a little central business district. Are there businesses there? Do you look at that and whether a downtown seems like it's doing well or not? And does that play into it?
Yes, we actually have a downtown specialist on our project. We do expect that that's part of the recipe, at least in some places, right? That downtown is a place for businesses. So having a strong business community, people wanting to own and operate a business in that community is great. It helps community members meet their needs. They can go shopping. They can find the services and products that they're looking for. But downtown also serves as a gathering place, and it can be a center for culture and arts as well. So downtown is certainly part of the fabric of livability we expect in a lot of places.
You mentioned rural tourism, and I wonder, could rural tourism help these communities?
I think in some places it's definitely going to be part of their strategy for long-term success, that people are always going to want to visit, you know, beautiful high amenity places, and that finding ways to fold that into an economic development strategy, because it can fluctuate, it can be seasonal. So there are some maybe limitations, but I certainly think that understanding that aspect of your community and how to make it part of your success will be important in some places.
With a locality's economic development strategies, do you think our government's creating disadvantages for rural areas when it comes to development and wanting to guide businesses toward metro areas?
You know, I think it, you know, varies from place to place, and the role of government and local government varies. I think some places are more engaged than others. And certainly there are businesses that want to be in rural areas because the business owner likes the amenities. They want to live in a particular community, and it's their preferences that are going to drive where the business locates. Certainly there are, you know, maybe bigger corporations that have a more complex system for making a decision about where they're going to locate. But I think a lot of small businesses, it's about where does the owner, where do the employees want to live? And that's where the business locates.
UW-Madison Economic Development Specialist Tessa Conroy has this new project underway to help solve unique challenges occurring in Wisconsin's rural communities. You can be part of this discussion. Call in with a question, add comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new project underway at UW-Madison examines the key assets needed to sustain rural communities and support the quality of life in sparsely populated parts of Wisconsin. You can join the discussion at any point, calling in with a question or a concern. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Tessa Conroy is here, Associate Professor of Agriculture and Applied Economics at UW-Madison, where she heads up the Rural Livability Project. Tessa, it's called, of course, Brain Drain, Remaining a Concern in Wisconsin Communities, referring to when young people move away from rural areas to jobs in the cities. How much of an issue is brain drain in Wisconsin?
I think it's a concern in some places, in some rural communities. They tend to be very worried about, especially the kind of young adults leaving their community. When we engage with those communities, we try to think about the bigger picture. So in some instances, we might actually want young adults to leave the community for a while. Maybe they go get skills or training that they can't get locally. Maybe they move, find a partner, start a family. And then when they're ready to kind of buy a home, think about a long-term place to live, we talk about boomerang migration, that this would be the time that they want to come back to the community. So we try to help them think about what are the features of your community that are going to make these people want to come back and live here when they're ready and reach that stage of life.
Thinking about so many folks working remotely and the efforts to spread broadband across Wisconsin, especially in rural areas, when you talk about that scenario of moving back later in life, after establishing, a career, what impact does broadband have?
I think broadband and the potential for expansion in Wisconsin presents a real opportunity for a lot of communities because people are less anchored to their places of work. So we have more ability to live where we want to live based on our preferences. And so again, it comes back to what makes your community preferable to these people who can work remotely potentially. So broadband is certainly part of the equation, but they're probably not just looking for broadband. As we talked about earlier in the show, a nice downtown might be really valuable to some people. They might be looking for those critical institutions. Can they meet their needs on a regular basis, whether it's the pharmacy, the grocery store? Natural amenities are always, important. They enter into the equation for a lot of people. They want to live someplace that maybe has nice weather or nice views or lakefront or, all of these different types of elements of a place that are going to make a person want to choose that community.
The Wisconsin Policy Forum is reporting that our state's rural communities are growing faster in population than most other Midwestern states. Is rural Wisconsin bucking trends that are hurting rural areas in other states?
Yeah, certainly a lot of places in Wisconsin are doing really well. And I think that's part of the motivation for our project is we want to understand those places that are doing well by different metrics. I don't consider growth the only way to measure thriving or success, but it is one metric. And there are places in Wisconsin, a lot of them doing really well. But we still also do have places that are facing population decline. On average, though, we are seeing this increase based on that recent data.
Will the Rural Livability Project look into the effects of climate change on rural areas, especially as farming communities, face droughts and other weather disasters or people want, migration of people from areas that are extremely affected? How will you examine climate change in this?
I expect that that will show up in multiple ways throughout the project. I think climate is starting to affect people's choices of place to live. It's a stronger factor, I think, as you mentioned, how it's shaping industry, particularly farming, is going to change economic opportunities in places. I think the way climate is kind of weaves throughout all of the elements of the community is going to show up in the Rural Livability Project.
Will you do first-person interviews? What type of information will you be gathering from communities and from individuals?
Yeah, so those of us on the project are primarily with UW Extension. So we're often out in communities having conversations about the challenges that they're facing. We're also learning about success strategies and what's working well for places. Helping them understand, the kind of menu or range of economic development strategies and what might be most appropriate for their particular region, and just trying to have really informed discussions about how to move forward with their local goals. And so I would say that that's integrated all throughout the project, that we're just constantly in a two-way conversation with the communities that we'd like to serve.
We're discussing efforts to make a rural area more livable and stable. Tessa Conroy with us, associate professor and an economic development specialist who is leading the Rural Livability Project at UW-Madison. You can join in with your questions and share your comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tessa, what is the timeline for the Rural Livability Project? When do you find benchmarks along the process?
Our project officially starts September 1st. So we're already up and running and kind of getting the talented people that we'd like to have on the project working with us. We're hopeful that over the coming year, we'll engage with some communities and have those conversations that can be steering and guiding for us. The project lasts officially about 3.5 years, but we're hopeful that in a year, year and a half, by the end of 3 years, that we're sharing this information back with communities and we have some helpful and useful strategy and policy information that can be of service to rural areas.
In your study, looking at how really key institutions, pillars in a community, have a role in the health of it, how does the presence or lack of a bank, say, or a grocery store or a pharmacy, how does it affect the strength of a rural community?
Yeah, I think this comes down to, again, that ability to meet your needs on a routine basis. Oftentimes traveling further for a grocery store or for a healthcare provider in a rural area. And that can add up all of those inconveniences. And maybe pretty soon people start thinking, well, I'll just live in the next town over. With regard to banking, the implications of losing a community bank can kind of even ripple through the business community. Those community banks can have a really important role in servicing local rural small businesses that might have difficulty accessing a loan, say, through a large commercial bank. But in a community bank scenario where these banks are more oriented towards a mission of serving their community, I was in a conversation with one banker who, you know, has said, you know, maybe it doesn't make the most sense on paper, but we're going to do some of these things because it's the right thing to do for our community. And so that sort of reciprocity and the goodwill that these institutions have can really make a difference. And one, for, you know, business owners and residents, but also just in a collective way for the ability to stay in a place and make it possible to be there, live day to day, and again, meet your needs regularly.
In our last few moments together, if your project does crack the secrets to what makes a rural community weak or strong, how can that information be used?
Yeah, so we hope at the end that we can have really productive educational products and information to share with communities. So, for example, can we work with a community to help them better understand themselves in terms of kind of what type of place they are and the key factors that are important for them, given their goals that, you know, that community has set for themselves? And then can we start to maybe prioritize certain institutions? Like, okay, you know, we're maybe on the verge of losing our school, and that's going to be really, really important actually for our long-term success. So let's prioritize that. Or maybe it's the bank, or maybe it's economic opportunity, which has really shifted in rural areas, particularly with regard to manufacturing and agriculture. So is this actually about jobs? So in some places, you know, thinking about institutions, others amenities, others industry, and helping people prioritize what's important. And I think take a systems approach to economic development, that we probably can't just address one thing and expect big results. That in a lot of places, it's going to be looking at a combination of factors, a system of features of the community, and understanding how they work together and thinking about strengthening the system as a whole.
Tessa, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tessa Conroy heads up the Rural Livability Project at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.